This is WCSX Online. Our live web stream begins in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-HANSONS. Enter our exciting home makeover sweepstakes by clicking on the banner above. You can win the home improvement of your dreams. Windows, siding, roofing, doors, gutter protection. Come on, you can win. Get it done.
The ingredients of junk foods are subsidized.
Childhood obesity is of such a epidemic nature now. What do you think are the most effective steps that can be taken?
Well, you see, I actually think that you can do some education, but mostly you have to change the environment. Right now we have an environment that promotes overeating, and that environment is recent. It's only occurred within the last 25 years, those environmental changes that have fostered overeating. So you have to change the environment so it's easier for people to make more healthful choices. And there are lots of ways that are being looked at to do that. One is to change the subsidy structure so that fruits and vegetables will be cheaper than junk food. Another is to set up restrictions on what can be marketed, what can be sold, how foods are marketed. There are a whole range. I think training people to try to go for longer periods of time without eating would probably be a good idea. Eat less.
So you've said we eat too much. You also said we eat too often. So you say...
And we eat in too many places, and we eat too large portions.
Too many places. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's food available everywhere. There didn't used to be food available in bookstores, clothing stores, business stores. That's a relatively recent development. Vending machines in schools, that's only within the last 10 years. Larger portions since the mid-80s. And then a social environment in which it has become acceptable to snack all day long.
Has the sort of breakdown of the family dinner table pattern that's happened over the last 30 years or so with TV dinners, and has that affected the way people eat?
Sure. It's, again, a matter of not eating all day long. If you have a family dinner, you're not allowed to eat before dinner. You come to the table hungry. That's very different from carrying around power bars all day long.
What do you think can be done to limit the marketing of junk food to children? Is this something...
Oh, I think you need regulation.
From the federal level?
Yeah, I do. Because the industry has had plenty of time to self-regulate, and it's clear that it can't. I mean, the food industry is caught in a terrible position. I mean, really, between a rock and a hard place. Their job is to make money and sell products. And anything that's going to impede that imperative is something they just can't do.
Well, when you're looking at federal regulation, given the politics of this and the economics of it, how likely is it that we'll have...
Not in this administration. Mm-hmm. Well, there are 50... one of the things the Food Marketing Report did was it talked about 50 countries throughout the world that have instituted some regulations of food marketing. So it's not completely unheard of. And there's more and more interest in trying to do regulation. And the industry is scrambling to try to convince everybody they can self-regulate. But I'm not convinced.
Final thoughts about obesity in children. This is something that has suddenly become a fashionable topic for many people. But do you think it's going to result in significant change?
I think, as I tried to explain, I see this as an environmental problem. And in order to change this, you have to make changes at very many levels. No one change is going to make that much difference, if any, although it might make specific changes to individuals. I'm very impressed with what's going on in schools. I think that at least teaches children that food is beyond hamburgers and hot dogs, and I think that, and pizza. I think that's very useful as a long-term strategy. But until we change the environment so kids eat less and are more active, we're going to have a big problem.
Nutritionist Marion Nessel. Eat less and exercise more. Yeah, right. Tell that to your teenager. As teens juggle the demands of school, homework, sports, and a frantic social schedule, they skip sit-down meals with family in favor of burgers, fries, and vending machines. And wherever they go, they're offered supersized portions that seem like the ultimate meal deal. Parents, too, are pressed for time and often find fast or frozen foods the best substitute for home cooking and family dinners. Not so for Amy Salzman, a parent and nutrition columnist for Parents Action for Children. She joins us from her home in Washington, D.C. to share her experiences trying to get her kids and others to eat well in an often unhealthy social environment.
As hard as it is, I think, in this culture to be reminding kids, you know, on a fairly regular basis that eating healthy is part of being, you know, a well-rounded, happy individual, we have a responsibility to do that. And it's tough. I mean, everything around our kids is supersized everything. And the message we're sending to our kids is don't respect your body. Put whatever in it that you feel like. So I think it's part of a general message about respecting yourself. And kids get that. But I think sometimes that message does get lost because they compare themselves to, you know, the kid next to them who's coming to lunch, you know, bringing a lunch to school that's nothing but cookies, potato chips, and soda, which really does happen.
It would seem also, particularly when kids are younger, they are patterning their own eating on what their parents are providing them to some extent. As they get older into the teenage years, are they looking more at what peers are eating than what their parents are serving?
Yeah, I think that's right. Not that they won't eat what their parents are serving, but they're spending more time with their peers and they're more influenced by their peers. I mean, that's part of what happens in teenage years. Their social group is huge for them. And so it's like saying no to anything else. For some kids, you know, everyone else is going out for Coke and, you know, whatever after school, and they want to be part of that. So it's very hard, I think, to say to your kids, you can never do this. And I think that's where parents, you know, have to be smart about this. Again, you know, let them know what healthy eating is about and hope they make those decisions, right? And then at home, don't have sodas there. Have other drinks that, you know, I mean, water and milk and seltzer water mixed with juice, you know, that's fine. I mean, we never have soda in our house, and I don't think my kids feel particularly deprived. Might have pretzels instead of greasy potato chips. But, you know, have snack food, but, you know, have it be food that is relatively healthier. And so at least when they're home, they're getting the message that this is what healthy eating is, and forming habits at home that hopefully will extend into the rest of their lives.
Sitting down to both breakfast and dinner doesn't happen as much anymore in families. Families don't spend a lot of time at the dinner table, you know, having conversation and lingering and eating the food gradually, etc. Is that a trend that actually reinforces the sense of eating on the run and eating rather carelessly?
Oh, without a doubt. I think when dining is not part of the family routine, dining together as a family, it just becomes yet another sort of fast food, let's get ourselves filled up, move on to the next activity. And the other practical issue is if you're not eating together more regularly as a family, you're not really seeing what your kids are eating that much. There's not a way to really role model good eating behavior as frequently.
As a parent, you don't want to be seen as a nutritionist. You don't want to be seen as a dietitian. And the term healthy, which may mean good things to a 6-year-old, is going to seem awfully stodgy to a 13-year-old. Is that right?
Well, the word itself, perhaps, but making the word make sense in the context of their lives, I'm not sure does. I mean, showing how food affects how they feel, for instance. Kids who are very involved in sports, you know, they quickly find out if they don't eat well, they don't have the energy to perform well. You know, the connection between feeling good, you know, having high self-esteem, feeling good about yourself, and eating well does come. I mean, it's true that our teenagers don't want to constantly hear us talking about, well, you're not eating a healthy, balanced diet. What are you thinking? I mean, that's not going to work. That will definitely not work.
That is so not cool.
Right. It's just not cool. But, you know, eating, role modeling good eating to them, obviously, from, you know, what you do yourself. And, you know, when, as I said before, when the opportunity presents itself to make those connections, help them make those connections. You know, you're feeling kind of run down today. I can see you run down. So what do you have for lunch? And maybe they'll admit to you that they had, you know, cookies and potato chips. Maybe they won't, but they know what they had, and they can make the connection, and next time maybe eat something a little more nutritious.
I find that shopping together, I mean, cooking together is one thing and it's extraordinarily important, but it seems that shopping is also a very important thing to do together so that your child begins to understand and actually make choices. First of all, you make sure you go through a market that doesn't have a lot of junk food. In other words, go to a market in the first place that tends to take a lot of those things, not even put them on the shelves. But then the kinds of choices you make, both for health and for economy, seem to me very important. Like you reason through that with your child.
Yeah, one thing I want to say, though, is that, you know, a lot of people simply don't have access to the kind of markets for shopping healthy that people who live in more middle-class, upper-middle-class neighborhoods do. And, you know, one of the things we deal with at Parents Action for Children is trying to educate parents who live in lower income neighborhoods where, you know, the only market within walking distance, and, you know, many people don't even have cars, you know, sells, you know, wilted lettuce and produce that, you know, looks like it's been sitting there for weeks. And so the most appetizing thing is the chips and the crap. I think we have to understand that there are a lot of people out there who don't have the access to a variety of foods in a way that would be considered ideal. This is where, you know, making changes in schools is vitally important because for a lot of kids, that's where they get their main meals of the day. And if they're not getting, and if they're filling up on junk food at school, then they're never getting the healthy kind of nutritious diet, well-balanced diet they need. So, you know, there are all kinds of efforts underway in various school districts. I know California has done a lot on this issue. Nationally, there's legislation right now to basically get rid of junk food in schools. So, you know, I think as a society, there's a lot we could be doing to help on this issue.
Amy Salzman, columnist for Parents Action for Children. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
Digital audio on your desktop.
Computers can do that?
The Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX.
Bell-bottom.
Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX. Is 94.7 WCSX Birmingham, Detroit, USA.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, as we record the show, the House has passed legislation on military commissions and detainee treatment that will allow forms of detainee abuse, recognized internationally as torture, make secret evidence and coerced evidence admissible in court, and degrade habeas corpus, the traditional right of prisoners to challenge their detention. Why are the media largely ignoring the substance and significance of the bill in favor of stories about the political battles over it? We'll talk with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also on the show, FCC Chair Kevin Martin has called for an investigation into the suppression of research that's starting to look like something of a habit for the commission. What was in those studies on media ownership that the FCC disliked so much they had them quashed? We'll hear from Hannah Sassaman of Prometheus Radio Project. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
In its October 2nd edition, Newsweek reports that in Afghanistan, the religious zealots who harbored Osama bin Laden before 9/11 are surging back into the country's center. Important news? Newsweek thought so. It put the story headlined "Losing Afghanistan" on the covers of its European, Asian, and Latin American editions. The United States, though, was literally a different story. U.S. readers got Annie Leibovitz, My Life in Pictures, a roundup of portraits from the noted celebrity photographer. Ironically, one of the pictures is a group shot of Bush and his national security officials all doing their best to look tough in December 2001, right after the invasion of Afghanistan that Newsweek now reports is not going so well. This may seem like just another example of U.S. media's political timidity, Newsweek thinking that even though its reporters find that the U.S. is losing Afghanistan, it might not be a good idea to be so honest with U.S. readers. But there may be media corruption as well as media cowardice involved. Amidst the spread on the photographer Annie Leibovitz, there are three full-page ads for Nikon cameras. It's obvious that placement of these ads next to this story is no coincidence, even though this violates the traditional journalistic ethic of separating news and advertising. And if Nikon is willing to pay to place its ads next to a particular story, wouldn't it pay more to get its ads in a particular cover story? Newsweek gets more money, Nikon sells more cameras, everybody wins except readers.
It seems one can't go a week without catching another example of mainstream media cautioning the Democratic Party back from the far-left abyss. This week it's Time magazine, and the context is the disastrous effect of liberal blogs. In the September 24th edition, Perry Bacon Jr. traced Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman's defeat by anti-war challenger Ned Lamont to bloggers who had, quote, fanned anti-incumbent and anti-war flames, close quote. Looking at New York, Bacon wrote that after bloggers, quote, relentlessly derided Senator Hillary Clinton as calculating, overly cautious, and lacking true liberal bona fides, she hired an advisor just to deal with them and even demanded that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld resign, close quote. His conclusion, quote, progressive bloggers are pushing the Democratic Party so far to the left that it will have no chance of capturing the presidency in 2008, close quote. So, getting leading Democrats to speak out against a war that is overwhelmingly unpopular with the American public is so far to the left as to put the White House out of reach, as is calling for Rumsfeld's resignation, though Time reporters might be expected to know that no less than six retired senior generals have publicly called for Rumsfeld to step down in the past year. Presumably, Time would have it that they were victims of the rabid liberal blog's inexorable leftward push as well.
David Ignatius is an Iraq War devotee and a Washington Post columnist. That's not exactly redundant, but it's close. In an indignant September 27th column, Ignatius admitted that things were very bad in Iraq, but then directed his indignation towards Democrats for not coming up with a winning plan. Ignatius even suggested that some were taking satisfaction and political advantage of the dire situation in Iraq. Quote, some extreme war critics are so angry at Bush, they seem almost eager for America to lose, to prove a political point. Even among mainstream Democrats, the focus is gotcha, rather than what next, close quote. Ignatius seems most angry about calls for troop withdrawal. Quote, here's a reality check for the Democrats. There is not a single government in the Middle East, with the possible exceptions of Iran and Syria, that favors a rapid U.S. pullout from Iraq, close quote. The views of unelected heads of state might be interesting. However, what about democracy? What about what Iraqis think? That same day's Washington Post happened to have three reports on Iraqi public opinion, all showing a majority favoring withdrawal. The Project on International Policy Attitudes, for instance, found 71% favoring withdrawal within 6 months, and 61%, including majorities of both Sunnis and Shiites, approving of attacks on American troops. These figures are apparently unimportant to Ignatius, whose dismissal of Iraqi opinion is consistent with his urging Democrats to turn their backs on the majority of Americans who also favor withdrawal. Columnists like Ignatius like to write in lofty terms about democracy, but it's helpful to know that they aren't invoking the will of the people, but a consensus of elites, elected or not.
Elite U.S. media had a field day with Hugo Chavez's September 20th address to the United Nations, in which the Venezuelan president excoriated George Bush and his policies in very colorful terms. A New York Times piece the next day included the notion, attributed to Bush defenders, that at least the United States had let Chavez make his remarks, quote, without being thrown in jail, close quote. Though many might suggest that upholding basic laws of free speech isn't really anything to write home about. The Times piece, which, like much of the coverage, seemed to imply that tough criticism of the U.S. in itself puts someone outside the realm of serious conversation, presented Chavez as in competition with Iranian President Ahmadinejad in what the headline called a battle of anti-U.S. soundbites. It also included what reporters perhaps deemed yet another laughable attribute of the South American leader. He doesn't even know if people he admires are alive or dead. After the UN address, in which Chavez praised a book by U.S. foreign policy critic Noam Chomsky, the Times reports, Chavez told a news conference, quote, that one of his greatest regrets was not getting to meet Mr. Chomsky before he died. Mr. Chomsky, 77, is still alive, close quote. Yes, Chomsky is still alive, though you might not know it from reading the New York Times. And the paper, as it turns out, may not even be right about Chavez's comment. Reuters also covered that news conference, but their September 21st article reports that Chavez, quote, told New Yorkers to read Abraham Lincoln and Mark Twain, as well as modern thinkers like Noam Chomsky and John Kenneth Galbraith, lamenting he could not meet Galbraith before he died in April at age 97, close quote. Careful reader Robert Naiman of the group Just Foreign Policy pointed out the discrepancy in a letter to the Times that the paper didn't publish. Reuters might have it wrong, of course, or the Times might have made a simple translation error. Unfortunately, it's also the case that there are just some people about whom it seems any purported gaffe is worth pointing out, but not necessarily fact-checking.
And finally, in an interview with Barbara Walters on ABC's 2020, Fox's Bill O'Reilly made a dramatic claim that, quote, "The FBI came in and warned me and a few other people at Fox News that Al-Qaeda had us on a death list," close quote. Viewers might have a hard time assessing such a claim. On the one hand, O'Reilly has used a prominent media position to advocate for racial profiling of Arab Americans, condone torture in the name of the war on terror, and support the invasion and war on Iraq in terms that could only be called bloodthirsty. On the other hand, not every self-aggrandizing autobiographical tidbit O'Reilly has offered over the years has stood up to examination. Marcus Barham of Radar Online sought to confirm O'Reilly's claim, and after interviewing people at Fox News, ABC, CBS, and the FBI, Barham concluded that the purported threats did not exist. It would be just another O'Reilly makes stuff up story, but for the grace note provided by the Fox Network's defense of their star. Fox Media Relations Director Leah Yoon told Barham that the network had, quote, "nothing to say about the matter." Why? Because the interview aired on ABC. Quote, "We shouldn't be shouldering the burden of something he said on someone else's network," close quote. Once again, journalistic responsibility redefined by the Fox News Channel.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
We are taping this show on September 28th, the day after the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation on military commissions and detainee treatment, which greenlights detainee abuse, okays internationally recognized forms of torture, and degrades the writ of habeas corpus, the ability to challenge one's detainment, a legal principle rooted in Western tradition going back to the signing of the Magna Carta 800 years ago. But you might not know all this from many mainstream news accounts, which seem to find the substance of the bill a yawn and prefer to focus on the sexy rift between George Bush's White House and those roguish Republican mavericks headed by Arizona's John McCain. When not focused on that rift, reporters largely obsess on how the bill's passage will affect the electoral prospects of Republicans and Democrats this fall. Joining us now to talk about the bill and how it's been covered is Michael Ratner. He's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the leading group fighting for the rights of Guantanamo detainees. Michael Ratner, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Michael, how bad is the legislation?
This is really bad. I remember 5 years ago after 9/11 writing an article called "Moving Toward a Police State," or "Have We Arrived?" Well, you can say we've arrived. This is really about tyranny in America. It deprives people of the most fundamental rights, rights that go back 500 years. One of them, of course, the writ of habeas corpus, which gives you the absolute right to go into a court and challenge your detention. And what this legislation does, it doesn't just degrade habeas corpus, as you said, Steve. It actually abolishes it for aliens anywhere in the world. You can pick up a legal permanent resident in the United States, hold him as a so-called enemy combatant forever, and they never get to go into a court. That's one of the most amazing aspects to me. It obviously goes back to the Magna Carta in 1215. It obviously applies to all of the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo detainees. They're trying to get rid of not only those cases, but they really want the right to set up a police state with regard to aliens, and of course citizens are next. So that's one aspect of the legislation. A second aspect, which has been much talked about, is this question of torture. And of course it's been phrased, and I agreed with that statement that you made, as a debate between the president on one side, McCain, Warner, and Graham on the other, as if somehow there's this serious internal rift in the Republican Party. But let me tell you, there was no internal rift in the Republican Party about habeas corpus, which was barely covered in the press until only recently. And yes, there's been some talking about torture, but no one's really talking about the fact that they sealed that rift, and the bill still allows torture to occur. It sets the parameters of that, allows the president to basically say what kinds of techniques he can use. And yeah, maybe he can't actually put a thumbscrew on you, but he can certainly put you into a stress position, put you through hypothermia, and conceivably put you through mock drowning, or waterboarding as it's called. So it still leaves that very broad authority to the president, not just, first of all, as I said, on habeas to lock you up, but once you're inside, to torture you. And then it does something that's really been outrageous to me, is it immunizes all of the past conduct of people, not just the lower-level CIA guys. I mean, those guys should be worried, but it really immunizes, and in part this bill is about that, immunizes from any future prosecution the Donald Rumsfelds, the Alberto Gonzaleses, the Addingtons, the vice president, or the president, who've essentially authorized war crimes, torture, over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we have a criminal statute making that kind of conduct illegal. And what this bill does is says you have immunity from that. And lastly, as you said, it's called the Military Commission Act. Some 85 or 90 pages of the 95-page act are devoted to military commissions. Now, I should say, in some way, that's a diversion, because, as I said, we got habeas in there, you got torture in there, and you got immunity in there. But on military commissions, it tries to reverse or overturn the case that was decided in June of this year, the Hamden case, that said the president was proceeding unlawfully in trying to try people by military commissions. It doesn't do a good enough job to overturn it, I'll tell you that, because you're still allowed to use evidence that comes in from coercion, which in this administration is really torture. You're still allowed to exclude the defendant from seeing certain evidence, and you're still allowed to bring in all kinds of hearsay evidence. This bill is a disaster. I want to just say, today is the day that we're recording this, that the Senate is voting on this bill. And I just spent 2 days in Washington trying to deal with this bill and the congresspeople, or the senators in particular, on the issue of habeas corpus stripping. And I saw the vote, and I really started to cry when I saw it. We lost the vote. We got 48 votes that were going to say we should not strip habeas corpus from people. It's a fundamental right. And 51 votes against this, and we lost it, which means that as you're hearing this program, there is no longer a writ of habeas corpus if you're picked up as an alien anywhere in the world, even in the United States, and held as an enemy combatant.
Michael Ratner, while the press hasn't gotten the historic import of this legislation, there have been exceptions, such as Dan Frumkin at WashingtonPost.com and Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com. What's your assessment of the press coverage of this legislation?
In some way, they covered this like a football game between two teams that are in the same league. So it was covered by the president on one side and McCain and Warner on the other side, and that was it. And so you never heard a word about habeas corpus. You heard some stuff about torture. You never really heard about how they were immunizing all of these people, which is, of course, illegal to do under international law. The coverage was just terrible. And it took us until the last few days to really begin to get anywhere on the coverage. And, of course, the last few days are quite late. We came close. But there should have been press out there for months saying, what are we talking about? These are fundamental rights, not to be tortured, to have a right to go into court, to have a fair trial. These are rights that are really the core of our American value system, or should be. And the press just was asleep at the switch.
In another exception, Rosa Brooks wrote a scathing denunciation of the Military Commissions Bill in the Los Angeles Times, in which she concluded, Bush isn't stupid. He understands that it's far too late for him to leave a legacy that won't be a source of shame to future generations. So he's going for second best, a congressionally delivered get-out-of-jail-free card. Do you think she's going too far?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when they started torturing people 4 or 5 years ago, the memos that were written said, we better not apply Geneva here, because if we apply Geneva, we might be guilty of war crimes. And they've been concerned by that issue tremendously over the last 4 or 5 years. And when you got a Supreme Court all of a sudden saying, you might be guilty of war crimes because Geneva applies here, these guys got very, very nervous. Some future prosecutor, who knows who they'll go after. And when we look back on this, this will be the shame of this country, much like the Japanese concentration camps were in the Second World War. And there's a good chance that some of these guys could get it, and they're not sleeping well at night. So really what Bush did was really pardon himself and the administration. Rather than having to say, I pardon you, he simply passed a law saying, there's no more criminal law for this anymore, and we make it retroactive. We can't be prosecuted.
On the day we're recording this show, on September 28th, the New York Times ran a very strong editorial condemning this legislation. But it came out the day after the House passed the bill. What do you think about the timing?
Well, the timing was obviously terrible. I mean, my listserv, which we have on Guantanamo, circulated that editorial this morning. The House we had lost. I mean, I have to be honest with you, Steve. We weren't going to win the House. But the day it came out this morning is the Senate vote. And, of course, what could we do with it? They're already on the floor of the Senate voting. Some of them may have read it, but we didn't get to really generate the kind of buzz we needed. And, of course, it should have come out weeks ago. And they used the word in there. They used the word tyranny in there, which is remarkable for the Times, of course. I mean, they've been very slow to getting it, very slow to using the word torture, very slow to talking about the writ of habeas corpus. Finally, on the day of the vote, when basically I'm back here and I've been in Washington for 3 days and I'm back here now, and what can I do with it? You know, I can hang it on my wall and say, yeah, the Times agrees with me.
We've been speaking with Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael Ratner, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you, Steve.
We told Counterspin listeners a couple of weeks ago about a 2004 study commissioned by the FCC on the effects of media ownership on local news. It seems that the report, commissioned under then-FCC Chair Michael Powell, didn't find what the agency hoped it would. In any event, the FCC, we now know, ordered it destroyed, literally. And it only came to light when it was leaked to California Senator Barbara Boxer, who questioned current FCC Chair Kevin Martin about it at his renomination hearing. The plot has thickened further now, as it appears the localism study was not the only one the FCC commissioned and then suppressed. A second report has come to light, and there may be more. But as of now, none of this appears to be stopping the FCC from going forward with the latest round of proceedings aimed at reworking media ownership rules. Here to bring us up to date on this evolving story is Hannah Sassaman, an organizer at Prometheus Radio Project. Welcome to Counterspin, Hannah Sassaman.
Thank you so much.
Well, tell us first of all what was in the reports that we know to have been quashed. What was this information that the FCC wanted destroyed?
Well, if you're asking about the second paper that surfaced that Barbara Boxer brought to light at the reconfirmation hearing of Chairman Martin, it was called The Review of the Radio Industry. Now, the FCC internally at its media bureau studies the radio industry periodically and asks questions about concentration, about how well the stations supposedly are serving our American communities. But this particular one from 2003 under Chairman Michael Powell shows that the number of radio station owners had declined due to the consolidation that happened after the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and after the FCC implemented rules which allowed corporations like Clear Channel from owning about 40 stations across the United States to almost 1,300. What this report found, among other things, was while there was a 5.9% increase in the number of radio stations that actually existed around the country, mm-hmm. there was a 35% decrease in the number of distinct owners of those radio stations between March 1996 and March 2003. So what we've shown is when the FCC works to consolidate, when our government works to consolidate the ownership of media in the hands of just a few companies, we're looking at a great lack of diversity of voices that happened around the United States. So it proves what we've been saying rather than what they would like us to believe.
And the first study, which we did talk about, but I'll just remind listeners, had to do with showing that when television stations were locally owned, they did in fact do more local news content, which was something else that the FCC had tried to say was not true.
That's right. Almost 5.5 minutes of local news were on each broadcast that was owned by a local company. 5.5 more minutes of coverage of city council meetings, of what's going on at your high school, of what's going on with the local church community, and 3 minutes of on-location news. That adds up to over 30 extra hours of local news that you get from your television stations when they're owned locally rather than by a distant owner like GE or Disney.
And we should be clear, it's not that the FCC released no studies on the potential impact of rolling back regulations. They released a number of them, all tending to support their line that deregulation didn't hurt localism or diversity. Well, for those of us who followed this battle closely over the years, this is all especially galling because FCC Chair Michael Powell went on at fatuous length about the importance of removing emotion from the debate and relying on empirical data. As an institution of government, he told the New York Times in 2001, we have to be able to justify on more than just a sentiment the continuation of a regulatory intervention. And he also said, the problem with diversity is that it has a visceral component. He was very dismissive of opponents to his view, and the thing he used to dismiss us with was research.
I agree. And something else that Michael Powell very famously said was that he waited all night for the angel of the public interest to visit him, to give him the public interest interest in what they cared about in media ownership, and she never came. But ironically, it was the fact that almost 3 million of us told the FCC in very specific anecdotal and statistical detail how media consolidation hurt our communities and how the ownership of local outlets helped us to participate in our democracy and in communicating with each other. So our data won and his data lost. And that's exactly why it's so important that now that Chairman Kevin Martin is trying to deregulate the American media system yet again, that we do the same thing that we did in 2003, that we tell the FCC our stories about how local radio stations, when they're owned by distant owners, when they don't let our voices on the air, hurt our ability to participate in the civic life of our community. If we do that, I know that we're going to be beginning to look at a media system that serves our communities much more than it ever did.
Are you encouraging people to communicate directly with the FCC?
Well, it's very easy for anyone who wants to communicate with the FCC to do so right now, because they have opened up a rulemaking asking the American communities if the FCC should be able to allow a company like Clear Channel or a company like Viacom to own both a television station and a newspaper in a single town. For example, you can tell the FCC that you want locally owned, locally controlled media outlets by going to stopbigmedia.com and sending in your comment. They're also going to be holding a number of official hearings around the country, and the first one they're doing is in Los Angeles on October 3rd. But we really need to push for the FCC to keep asking the American public what they want from their media systems for as long as we can, because we've seen that we can't really trust the FCC to even tell us what they've studied when it doesn't prove the points that they want it to prove. So until we can conduct an independent investigation that is totally independent of the FCC as to how media consolidation affects American communities, we need to make sure that they keep accepting our comments and give us as long as possible to tell them what we want from our media system.
And that website, again, was stopbigmedia.com. Let me ask you finally, Hannah Sassaman, back to the suppressed research story in particular. FCC Chair Kevin Martin has ordered an investigation by the Inspector General into the suppression of at least these two reports that we know about. I want to ask you, as it might even be a side note, but what do you hope for from the press corps on this? We at FAIR were told by one reporter that there's really no story here because he called the FCC and they told him that there was no conspiracy or effort to suppress information. So, you know, there's no story. What are you looking for from reporters, or what would you hope for from reporters on covering this story?
Well, I think it's really important to state, Janine, is that in 2000 and 2001, the effects of media consolidation were considered to be one of the most censored, one of the least told stories in the United States by Project Censored, which regularly covers stories that we don't hear about because the conglomerate media in the United States decides not to tell us. And so, first of all, the media needs to be reminded that they didn't do a very good job last time, and they haven't done one for years. The second thing that they need to realize is that the communities across the United States understand in a very sophisticated ways the relationship between all of the different media owners and the different kinds of telecommunications and media they get in their homes. They understand that when the FCC works to consolidate cable corporations and when state governments work to remove our rights to build community wireless networks, we know that it's the same companies pushing for this activity. So when reporters are covering this issue, what they're going to be faced with are extremely sophisticated, well-educated, diverse community members and citizens across the United States who understand it when corporations rob them of their rights. And so I would look to reporters to talk to those individuals and to get the story straight from them rather than just printing a press release directly from the FCC, from Comcast, from Clear Channel, or from NBC.
We've been speaking with Hannah Sassaman of Prometheus Radio Project. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio. From your classic rock home in cyberspace. 94.7 WCSX.
WCSX Classic Rock Web Stream.
night for a moon dance with the stars above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. All the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. Yeah, I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. Yet all the night's magic seem to whisper and hush. Yet all the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more romance with you, my love? Well, I wanna make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time is just right, and straight into my arms you will run. When you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own. And every time I touch you, you just tremble inside. Then I know how much you want me that you can't hide. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love?
WCSX, only because we had time for it not. Hey, all those Harvest Moons, have you checked those out the last few nights? Moondance and Van Morrison going to be in town in November. Looking forward to that show. Anyways, have yourself a good one. It's a minute before 6 o'clock, and that can only mean one thing now that we've adjusted his new time. Mr. Worby, good morning, sir, on a Sunday morning. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. You probably have heard that from pirate movies or something, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum and Sometimes when we're kicking back in the summer, people are having rum and coke or, you know, kind of those Hawaiian drinks or something like that. So rum, like most booze, is just thought of as that, something, a spirit that we use to, I don't know what, facilitate social gatherings or just to enjoy it. If I told you that I have a book in my hand called Rum and the experience of rum in the world, particularly a few hundred years ago, was very comparable to the role that oil plays today, I'll bet you that would surprise you. Well, it surprised me. The book is called Rum.